the idea is a $15 an hour job is a good paying job. $15 an hour is barely above the poverty wage.
Deller says these jobs also tend to have fewer opportunities for upward mobility, leading to higher numbers of working poor. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
In sports, opening day for the Brewers up at Miller Park. They take on the St. Louis Cardinals. The Cubs play in Texas. The Chi Sox are in Kansas City. In the NBA, the Bucks were off last night. The Bulls lost to Portland 118-98. Tonight, the Bucks host the LA Clippers. The Bulls are off. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Cloudy and mild today, a high of 57. Tonight, cloudy and cool, a low of 35. Tomorrow, Friday, cloudy, seasonal, a 50% chance of a rain-snow mix. Tomorrow's high, 46. Then for the weekend, a slight chance of a light rain-snow mix on Saturday, a high of 38. For Sunday, sunshine, a high of 40. Right now, partly sunny skies, a temperature reading of 47. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Today's morning show features an interview with former Major League Baseball player Ransom Jackson, recorded back in 2016. Mr. Jackson passed away on March 20th, and we are replaying this conversation in his memory. I am so excited about the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show because it is not every day that I get to speak with a Major League Baseball player, and especially with someone who has played against and with Jackie Robinson and other great legends of the game. I'm going to be speaking for the next few minutes with Ransom Jackson, known as Handsome Ransom.
And yeah, his better speaking.
Right. At any rate, the memoir that he has written is called Handsome Ransom Jackson, Accidental Big Leaguer, in which Ransom Jackson, or Randy Jackson as he was sometimes known, talks about the somewhat unlikely path that took him to his career as a Major League baseball player in the 1950s, a really crucial decade in the history of Major League Baseball. At one point in the book, he says, the 50s changed baseball forever and for the better. And it is a look backwards at a really important time, and also, in a sense, a look back at a bygone era. So it's such an intriguing book in so many ways, published by Roman and Littlefield and co-written by Galen White. Again, the book is called Handsome Ransom Jackson, Accidental Big Leaguer. Ransom Jackson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. How's the weather up there?
It is absolutely beautiful here today in southeastern Wisconsin.
It is here. The storm missed us.
Very good. Well, I'm so glad that I can be talking to you. Actually, even ahead of us talking about your own career and so on, I want to just make sure that we have a chance for you to talk about your co-author, Galen White. You call him a perfect fit. Tell us why this collaboration was such a happy one.
All right, here's what happened. All these stories, and my book is just stories. Nobody gets shot, nobody gets killed. It's just stories about the things that have happened to me over the years, both in college and growing up during the Depression, which most folks nowadays have never heard of the Depression. And then what I did in the big leagues and things that happened afterwards. And all my friends and my family and so forth over the years, and people I make speeches to, say, you know, you ought to put all that down on paper, because all these guys you're talking about, most of them are not here. And, you know, there's no way to verify that they're not here. You need to put it on paper. And so I said, yeah, I'll do that. And this years went by, and finally, a couple of years ago, I said, I'm going to do it. And I've got six kids and 12 grandkids and six great-grands, and I thought they deserved all these stories. They'd heard most of them, but I thought they deserved them on paper. So I sat down and got legal pads and started writing, and filled up four legal pads, which is something like 300 yellow pages. And my wife typed them up, and we looked at each other and said, well, what do you do now? And so a friend who had just written a baseball book about Steve Belko in Pacific Coast in California, and I happened to have played with Steve Belko, so it kind of fit. And I got a hold of Galen, and we talked, and he came down to Athens. He was in North Georgia, and he turned out to be the best I've ever seen as far as an author. He looks up everything. He'd take a paragraph of mine, turn it into four paragraphs. Just a beautiful fit. And here we are today. He sent it to his publisher, and his publisher took a week and a half to decide to go ahead and publish it, which I understand is kind of unusual.
Right, in this day and age. I want you to tell our listeners about a phrase that starts with the word bingo and ends with the word or the name Belko.
Now, Galen White threw that one out.
Right.
Yeah, he's very artistic, but I played with Ernie Banks. He was my shortstop when I was third base, and then the second baseman was Baker, and then there used to be a famous threesome for the Cubs. What was it? Tinker, to Evers, to Chance, and so Galen played around with it and came up with that phrase. So that's all his.
Right. Bingo to Bargo to Belko. Yeah. And in a sense, he was mentioning that is in terms of the seamlessness of the flow between you and he in this collaboration on this wonderful book called Handsome Ransom Jackson, Accidental Big Leaguer. Well, let's start at the beginning, where you grew up in the beautiful state of Arkansas.
Little Rock, Arkansas. Grew up during the Depression, and all we had was radio to entertain us, and most people nowadays don't even know what a radio is. you had to find something to do, so you'd go out over to a school, had a schoolyard, and if three guys showed up, you'd make up a game of four, and if 20 guys showed up, you'd get up a game of 20, and you just play and play until people decided they had to go home, and you just made up these games in your side yard and over at the school. And because we did not have any organized thing, you didn't have Little League back then, you just had to make do.
Hmm. So, and some of those games you were making up were, in a sense, baseball related, right?
Well, yeah, most of them were. Well, they were sports related. They were football too. You get two of us and get in the street and kick a football, and you had to kick it inside the street. You had to kick it straight. And it was just games are made up.
Right, and what a great creative venture for that, and a way to stay fit.
Yeah, we had one game and played in a guy's backyard. We had a fence in it. Backyard was fenced in, wooden fence, and you had a broomstick and two rolled-up socks. Taped up, and that was the ball. So you made up a game with a team of two guys, and he had a schedule, and people showed up to watch the game, and that went on all summer long. Mm. It didn't cost a thing.
Wow. As you reached your teenage years and reached high school, I know you tell us that there was no football team at your high school, and you didn't play baseball for your high school either, so I don't know if...
There was no baseball at high school.
Mm. So your sports were golf and track. Were you any good?
Well, first track meet I trained for the 220 the whole month, and then the first track meet, the coach says, you run the 440. And I said, what? I never ran a 440. So I ran 220 yards as fast as I could. And I was in first place. In the last 220, I was in last place because I could not last that long. So I wasn't much of a track man. Golf, I started at 12 years old and quit playing when I was 81. So I enjoyed that. But so we didn't have many sports. They did have basketball, take that back, because you didn't have much. It didn't cost you much to play basketball. The whole thing was money back then. Gas was rationed. So this was just before the war.
Right. So you actually end up not ever playing organized baseball or organized football, for that matter, until you get to college. First of all, explain the circumstances under which you went to college.
Well, of course, I graduated in 43 from high school and immediately went to the University of Arkansas because that's what most guys did. And 6 months later, I was getting close to my 18th birthday, and back then everybody had to register for the draft. And so I was going to be, always wanted to be a pilot in the Army Air Force. I knew every airplane in the German Army, the Japanese Army. And my dad was in the Navy Air Corps in Corpus Christi. And he didn't fly, but he was in charge of the cadets at one of the smaller fields. And he told me, he said, "Son, you don't want to be a pilot." He said, "I'm down here, and we have two or three crashes a day because we've got so many guys. What you want to do is go into the Navy Officers Training Program and be a cadet in the V-12 program." I said, "Dad, I don't know what that is." He said, "Well, that's what you need to do." I said, "Okay." So he swore me in. And I got a letter from the Navy, said, "We're going to send you to Texas Christian University," which I'd never heard of, in Fort Worth. And that's what they did. And I went there as a seaman and making $50 a month. And they had all these courses you had to take, 20 hours a quarter, a semester, whatever it was. And if you flunked out, then you went out to sea. And so I went out for football. I didn't have anything else to do. Well, I did have something to do because we had to study. We got up at 5:30, studied, went to class all day, studied it up until midnight. And I don't know why I went out for football, but I did. And the coach was Coach Dutch Meyer, who was in the Hall of Fame. He said, "What do you play, son?" And I said, "Coach, I've never played football before." I said, "I've dabbled in it, kicking and passing and playing around." He said, "Well, I'll make you a lineman." I was 6'1" and 160 pounds.
So not exactly a natural line.
No, and so I went over there and I start first day and, you know, start running to each other. And this guy was knocking me down, and I walked over to Coach Meyer at the end of the first day. I said, "Coach, I'm a backfield man. I saw those guys, backfield guys, passing around." So he said, "Okay." So the season started, and we had quite a few Navy guys on the team, but we didn't have many guys at all. And we ended up winning the Southwest Conference and going to the Cotton Bowl, and we were called the 15 Fighting Frogs, I think we were called, because we only had about 15 or 16 guys that played. And we won the conference. And we got beat by Oklahoma A&M, who had three All-Americans on it. We had Doodley Squat. We didn't have anything. And then we went, and the Navy school closed, and they sent me to University of Texas, a Navy school down there, and to finish up my midshipman school. And the coach down there was a guy named Dana X. Bible, who was also in the Hall of Fame. And he called me and he said, "Jackson, I saw you play at TCU. I want you to come out at the university." I said, "Coach, you know, I've got all this studying to do." And he said, "I sure would like it. We got a new quarterback coming in by the name of Bobby Lane. And we'd like for you to play." So I did.
I think you say in the book, you shouldn't say no to somebody whose last name is Bible.
That's true. And so anyway, we won the Southwest Conference again and went to Cotton Bowl, which has never been done, two straight Cotton Bowls with different teams. So, and then playing baseball, I went out there and I led the league in hitting at TCU, and I led it 2 years at Texas. And I got to play football with Bobby Lane and baseball with Bobby Lane, and he was a pretty good pitcher. His record for 2 years down there was 28-0.
You mentioned that you played halfback, but I think you were also a punter. And from the sounds of it, from your very first game, you were actually a pretty darn good punter. Actually, I think you were the backup punter, but then the first string punter got hurt. And
in the first game.
Oh, my gosh. So describe to our listeners that first game.
Well, I ended up, I didn't kick it 60 yards. I kicked it 35 or 40, but I was very accurate. And in the first game, I kicked the ball out inside the 10-yard line, I think, four, five, six times, which helped win the game. And the following Friday, before the next game, the president comes out on the steps of the administration building and greets everybody. Of course, TCU had 1,500 students at the time and 500 Navy. And he comes out and says what a great game it was last week, and Ransom Jackson was the star, and he asked me to come up and stand on the steps with him. And, gosh, I was standing there, like, drooling, like, ooh, here I am, standing up here with the president. And so, anyway, we went on to win both years, and it was unusual.
Right. This is probably as good a time as any to mention what is one of the predominant themes of your life, and certainly of this memoir, Ransom Jackson, Accidental Big Leaguer, and that is the fact that much of your success in your mind is due to the fact that you were in the right place at the right time. I mean, you were really, really fortunate. And I suppose in one way, it's really important that and good for you that you showed up at college at this point in time when the number of guys going out for sports was quite depleted. So you had coaches looking for players. And in a more normal season, maybe you never would have gotten that invitation to come out for football or come out for baseball.
That's very true. It just everything happened. And of course, I didn't plan anything. You know, a lot of kids nowadays, they plan, I want to play football here, I want to do this, I want to play baseball, I want to do that. But I did not plan any one thing in my life. I just was rocking along like a dumb teenager, and things were just going along. I'd play baseball, football, and then whatever. And then a guy offered me a contract to play professional baseball, and I could not name you one Major League Baseball player if my life depended on it. So since I led the league three straight years, he was the first and only scout that I'd ever met. He came up to me and said, "Do you want to play pro baseball?" And I said, "You know, I ain't got nothing else to do. I'm graduating. I got to do something. So I'll listen. What do you want?" He said, "Come up to Chicago and try out, and we'll see what we can do." And so I did with my dad, and I hit a couple of balls in the stands and fielded some balls. They called me in there. And the general manager said, "Well, we like what we see. What we're going to do, we're going to offer you a contract to play baseball with the Cubs, and a major league contract. And that means that there's 40 guys in a major league contract, and you get to go to spring training and everything with the big boys. And here's what we're going to offer you money wise. We're going to give you a 2-year contract. Think of that, 2 years, and we're going to pay you $6,000 a year." And I said, "Whoopee!" I turned a flip because I didn't have anything else to do with my life. So that's what we're talking about. Accidentally, you know, these things just came out and dropped in my lap, so I decided I'd go ahead and do it. Mm-hmm. So I went with them in 48 and just kept on playing and quit in 59 and got to meet all these fabulous people who played against all these fabulous baseball players. And I have so many stories in the book that it's just why I tell these stories, because most all these guys, 90% of them, are not here anymore.
Right.
And nobody will ever hear the story unless I tell it.
Right.
And I'm talking about, you know, Yogi Berra, Ernie Banks, and Duke Snyder, and Pee Wee Reese, and my roommate Don Drysdale, and all these people that I know and play with, and things that have happened. And I wanted to put them in a book so they'd be preserved for posterity. I found out, I guess 25 years later, the phone rang. It was my son in Columbus, Georgia. He said, "Dad, you know you were on Good Morning America." I said, "No, I didn't." He said, "Well, they had a question before they went to a break, and they said, who hit the last Brooklyn Dodger home run? And when they came back, they said it was you." And I said, "Well, I did not know that." and then I found out I was the first recorded intentional walk in the major leagues. And I did not know that. And then I researched, and one night in Brooklyn, playing against Philadelphia, the score was 5-2, and Pee Wee Reese got up, walked, and then Snyder hit a home run, which made it 5-4. Then I was batting cleanup, and I hit a home run, made it 5-5. And Gil Hodges hit a home run, and the game was over. That's three straight home runs in the bottom of the ninth. Well, we researched that for years and found out that that's never been done except that time. So he kept throwing these things around, and it was just all accidental. I didn't know these things were happening.
We're speaking with Ransom Jackson and his new memoir that has just been published is called Handsome Ransom Jackson, Accidental Big Leaguer. Ransom Jackson played for both the Cubs and the Dodgers in the 1950s, and he played both with and against some of the greatest legends of the game. And his wonderful book is filled to the brim with terrific stories about his experiences in Major League Baseball. So you are signed to the Chicago Cubs. I'm trying to remember if, as so often is the case, you had a stint in the minor leagues. I think you did. You played in Des Moines, right?
I started out in Des Moines, and then they sent me to Oklahoma City, and then I finished up and played a while in Springfield, Massachusetts. And while I was in Springfield, Massachusetts, I got to meet a mafia don, and he became a good friend of mine, and we did a few things together. So he's in the book. And most people don't run around with mafia dogs.
I have had the pleasure of doing a couple of morning show interviews about minor league baseball. And I know today, at least, life in the minor leagues can be, in a sense, kind of desperate because you have these young athletes who are just desperate to climb from the minor leagues to the major leagues. And so much is riding on their success and failure, and so it's packed with pressure, and of course it's a precious few ball players manage to ascend to the big leagues, and more end up crashing and burning or just fighting and failing and never quite managing it. What are your recollections of your time in the minor leagues? Did it feel like that to you, or was it just sort of fun? I mean,
fun. Just, you know, it was another thing to do. I was making enough money to get through the year, and including the off season, I made the 8,000 or 10,000, 6,000, whatever I was making, got me through. I did have to work a couple of off seasons, but it was just fun. And as far as saying I'm going to do this for another 10 years, it never entered my mind. I was just waiting for the next year's contract to go to spring training and start the fun all over again. It's kind of unusual, you know. Kids nowadays, they could hardly wait. They want to be a major leaguer. They go to college, which is kind of a minor league in itself, and they aspire to go up in the majors and make the big money, because the minimum salary now in the major leagues was $6,000 when I was there, and it's now $560,000. So if you get on a major league contract like I was, there's a big difference between $6,000 and $560,000. Now, you know, most folks can live on that. I don't know whether somebody on the radio can, but most average person can. But the money's great nowadays. But, of course, you've got so many kids coming out of college. There's so many different kids, but you've got so many more teams. We only had 8 to a league back then. And now, I don't know, they got 20. They got 50 to a league now, it seems like. There's one in every town.
Right. You write at one point, I think this is such a great line, baseball is a game where you can quickly go from the outhouse to the penthouse and back. So, in other words, when someone is playing the game of baseball, particularly at that level, Your fortunes can rise and fall, sometimes in really bewildering fashion. It sounds like, for the most part, your career in baseball was one of steady success. Nothing terribly spectacular, but you just sort of managed to get the job done. How would you sort of characterize your strengths and weaknesses as a ball player as you first reached the major leagues?
Well, I would say that I had a fairly good major league career. I got hurt too many times. That had happened. I had batting cleanup for the Dodgers, and turned the knob off on a porcelain shower, porcelain knob, and it broke off in my hand, and it ripped my thumb up all the way down to the bone, and so I was out, and Jackie Robinson comes back in and plays well, so I don't know how I would have done there. You know, you hurt your knee, somebody falls on your knee, and another year you get a spider bite, infects your hand where you can't play. So, I mean, I guess those are part of the game that you just have to accept. But, I hit three straight years. I hit 19, 20, 21 home runs. And if you make a couple of All-Star games, you're not doing too bad. But, you know, I'm sure I could have done better. But my ambitions and aspirations, maybe I didn't work as hard because, again, it came so easy to me.
Hmm. One of the significant things you saw in baseball, of course, was the emergence of Jackie Robinson as the first black player in the major leagues. And you were with the Chicago Cubs when the legendary Ernie Banks became the first black player. Chicago Cub.
Mm-hmm.
Ahead of us talking about both of these really important players, I wonder if you could just say a word about the reality of bigotry that we know was a part of life then, as of course it is to this very day. But, you know, we've all heard some of the horror stories about what some of these first black players encountered, not only from certain fans in the stands, but even from even teammates, let alone opponents from the other team who might not have welcomed their presence. We get the sense from reading your book that those kind of attitudes were really very alien to you, even though you had grown up in a place like Arkansas. Can you just say a word about what your own attitudes were about race at this point in time?
Well, of course, all that Arkansas stuff came after I left. I was never into that growing up. You know, back then, during the Depression, a person was a person was a person. You know, everybody was trying to get by. And then in college, in all my years in college, and I spent a lot of years in college, I never played with, I guess at one game, we played an Army Air Force base one time in football, and I think there were a couple of black linemen, but I never played against anybody until Ernie Banks came with or against, until Ernie Banks came in 53 or whatever, 54. So I was used to just people being people, and when I played against them, or then I started playing with them, you know, I was just, they were just another guy. And everyone I ever met was just another guy. And so I can very safely say that I didn't go through life with any kind of prejudice at all in sports. It was just, if a player can help you, if he was polka dot, you know, That was fine.
What are your most powerful recollections of the great Ernie Banks?
Well, of course, when Ernie first came up, we played side by side for a few years. And when he first came up and we started playing together after a few games, what I would do, I played third and Ernie played shortstop. and we were side by side, what I would do, I'd just move over closer to the third base line, and I turned to Ernie and I said, you know, take everything you can get. And he covered so much ground, and I could tell with his arm and his fielding and his wrists were just, they almost popped when he swung, that he was going to be a good one. And it turned out he did. And when I went up about 3 years ago to throw out the first ball in Chicago, and Ernie called me up before and said, I want to see you and talk to you beforehand. And we talked for about an hour on the phone. And we did. We talked, and I'm sorry I couldn't get Ernie to write my forward in the book. I'd planned on it because we were close enough where he would have done it. But as nice a guy as you'll ever find, and we got along great.
Hmm. You also say that Ernie Banks displayed the patience of Job with the Chicago Cubs because he didn't play on a winning Cubs team until 1963. That was 10 years after he first joined the Cubs. I bet as you see the Chicago Cubs doing so spectacularly well this year, and of course we don't want to jinx it by saying, you know what, how well they might ultimately finish this year, but I suppose you wish that Ernie Banks was still around to be enjoying their tremendous success in person.
Oh, I do, because being Mr. Cub, he would have been in high heaven, in hog heaven, so to speak, sitting up in the stands and watching those guys do as good as they've been doing. And I wish them well.
Hmm.
I hope they do. I just don't want any, you know, you've always got injuries and so forth. When I played, when we won the pennant with the Dodgers, it just happened on the last day. So we just lucked into it, so to speak. Not luck, we won a lot of games, but you had to wait till the last day to get in. I hope the Cubs, you know, in the last month, get 10 games ahead or something, so they can coast in. But I'm really pulling for them.
Hmm. Since we've been talking about Ernie Banks, let's leap ahead just a little bit and also talk about the man that you call the ultimate ball player, Jackie Robinson,
mm-hmm.
one that transcends all of the statistics used to measure performance. You say at one point in the book, you didn't like playing against Jackie, but you didn't mind playing with him. So in other words, you experienced Jackie Robinson's greatness both as an opponent and eventually as a teammate when you were traded to Brooklyn. Tell us about your recollections of your very first encounter with him when at that point he was an opponent.
Well, see, you've got to play at third base. You've got to play in because Jackie would butt a lot. And he'd also hit a line drive right past your ear. So you had to be aware. And then if he was on second base, then you had to be looking around all the time to be sure he didn't steal third. So, I mean, he was in the game all the time. So that was playing against him, not playing with him. I mean, I was glad to see all the things going on. And I watched him do all these things firsthand. Well, it was firsthand watching behind my back, but to sit there and watch him perform with the Dodgers when he was performing for my team was a great feeling.
So, what is your impression of him once you were teammates? I mean, one of the interesting things about that scenario was that you were essentially brought into the Dodgers organization at a point when Jackie Robinson was in physical decline, and mm-hmm. in a sense, it appeared that you were brought in to potentially replace him. So the relationship between the two of you, understandably, was probably a little bit awkward. Tell us about that relationship, especially right off the bat.
You know, the sports writers wanted it to be awkward. You know, every day or so, the sports writer would come up and say, "How are you and Jackie getting along?" I'd better get along fine. They, you know, they were hoping I'd say, "Well, you know, I don't really like that guy," but he was a great guy. He knew what was going on. And some days when I was playing, he would play second base. So he wasn't on the bench the whole time when I was playing. But we would talk about different players, where to play when they were up at the plate, what where we'd play in the field. And we got along fine. We had no problems whatsoever. He knew what was going on. I knew what was going on. The manager, the day before the first game of the season, the manager, Walter Austin, told me that he decided to go with Jackie. I played half the before the spring training. He played half spring training, and then Walter also said, "I'm gonna put Jackie in to start the season because he'd been here so long." And I said, "That's great. I understand. He deserves it." And then Jackie played for a month or so, didn't do too well, so I came in and batted clean up for the Brooklyn Dodgers, which was the greatest thrill of my life.
We're speaking with Handsome Ransom Jackson, and we're talking about his wonderful memoir called Handsome Ransom Jackson, Accidental Big Leaguer. Ransom Jackson played Major League Baseball for the Chicago Cubs and the Brooklyn Dodgers during the 1950s, a really exciting era in Major League Baseball. By the way, what did that feel like to be traded from the Cubs to the Dodgers? Was that a painful experience for you?
Well, a writer called me. I spent the winter that year into 55 in Chicago, just so I didn't want to drive all the way back to Georgia. And a sports writer called me, and he says, "You've been traded." And I said, "I've been traded. I just was an all-star for the Cubs for 2 years, and I've been here so long." He said, "Well, you've been traded." He said, "Guess who? Guess to who?" I said, "Don't give me that. I don't, you know." And I said, "Okay, Pittsburgh." He said, "No." I said, "Cincinnati." He said, "No, you've been traded to the Brooklyn Dodgers." I said, "You are full of it. Brooklyn had just won the World Series the year before. And, of course, one of my ambitions, the few ambitions that I had, was to play in a World Series. I knew that the Cubs wouldn't make it in my era. So it was just a great feeling to know that, gosh, I've been traded from, well, when I say a loser, we usually came in fourth, fifth, sixth in my years, to have the chance or the opportunity to be on a winner was just great. So I was very happy about that. And they traded me for three guys.
So that had to make you feel good.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was all over it.
You tell us in the book, in 12 years of pro baseball, you never met an agent.
That's true.
So, in other words, you went through your entire baseball career without an agent. Was that uncommon at the time, or was it fairly commonplace for a major league ball player to take care of all those such matters without the assistance of an agent?
There were agents around, and I think most of them were with Ted Williams and Mickey Mantle and the Pee Wee Reeses and so forth. I was just one of the lower group, and that's true. I've never met an agent in my life. Never made any extra money. Probably made $100 extra in all those years. So, you know, nowadays they get many millions for signing. I just didn't get any, but I didn't know the difference. So I took what I got.
One of the things that you make repeated mention of is the fact that when we look back at the decade of the 1950s, and we think about some of those extraordinarily beautiful ballparks in which the game was played. Mm-hmm. Only two ballparks remain from the 1950s, Chicago's Wrigley Field and Boston's Fenway Park. All of those other ballparks are gone.
Well, they've kind of messed Wrigley Field up, too, putting the higher walls in there. It's not as pretty as it was to me. This is just me talking. And why they did that, I have no idea, unless they needed room for more people. But it's not as pretty as it was, but it's still a beautiful park.
Right. You mentioned the fact that back in your day, there were often games in which the empty seats would outnumber the fans. That's true. Most of the seats in a ball game would be empty. Did that strike you as odd, or was that just the way things were back then?
Well, what do I know? You could go. I played a few games one year in the Boston Braves before they moved to Milwaukee. And I mean, you could hear the people talking. You could be out there and you could hear the people in the third row of what they were talking about. You know, there just wasn't that many people there. And you know, what did I know? I didn't know the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, in Chicago, we only drew 600,000 most of the years, and so you'd have 10,000, 5,000 people. That's not a whole lot compared to today. But that's all I knew. Whether there were a lot of people or just a few people, I just went out there and knew I was supposed to play the game.
Right. You did play some games in Milwaukee, and my recollection is that Milwaukee was not necessarily a city where you enjoyed some of your greatest successes, at least in the batter's box.
I did not. Could not. I think it was the background. Milwaukee had a background that was hard to see. I'm going to blame it on that anyway. And I just didn't have a success. In a lot of other parks, I had a success, but Milwaukee, I just didn't tear it up.
Hmm.
And I've got a few stories about some of the Milwaukee players in there, too.
One of the things you say is that roommates are a thing of the past in Major League Baseball. You say that's too bad because some of baseball's best stories were inspired by players rooming together during spring training or on road trips. Tell us a couple of your favorite roommate stories from your own life.
I roomed with Don Drysdale for a while. You've heard of him, haven't you?
All right.
And then one of my best roommates was Roger Craig.
Who wrote the foreword for your book.
Right, uh-huh. And I had my very first roommate in the major league was a little Italian guy by the name of Bob Ramazzotti, and he smoked these horrible, crooked Italian cigars. And after the first week, and he smoked them in the room. And after the first week, I went to the general manager and said, "Help! I want another roommate. I can't breathe." And so he did. But in all my 12 years of playing, every roommate I have except Bob Ramazzotti, well, he was a nice guy, but his cigars were bad news. Everybody was fine. I never bumped into anybody in all these years. I guess I ran across 300-400 guys I've played with. Everybody was nice. Never had any guy that I could say that I never did like that guy.
Hmm.
Just everybody was fine.
Hmm. You tell an interesting story about batting behind Hank Sauer in the lineup and how sometimes opposing pitchers would sort of take out their frustration on you.
That was not fun. In 52, when Hank Sauer was the most valuable player in the league, he had to come up and hit a home run, drive in 3 or 4 guys, and here I would be the next hitter, and here would come the ball at my head or at my chest or hit me in the rear end, and that was because Hank had hit a home run. You know, I had anything to do with it, and I had bruises on me all year long just because of Hank, and I forgot to tell Hank that I always hold that against him.
You also devote a whole chapter in the book to cheating. The title of the chapter is The Cheating Game, and you open it by saying baseball players in the 1950s didn't use performance-enhancing drugs, but that doesn't mean they weren't looking for ways to break the rules and get that competitive edge.
Yeah, there were a few cheaters, and you try to catch them. You find out there were some out in the scoreboards, you know, with the binoculars, and then you try to catch them, and some of them are loading up on the ball to pitch, and there was one with Milwaukee who was very well known by the name of Burdette, Lou Burdette, and then there's some guys, some coaches on the third base line who kind of inch over towards third base line, and they had whistles. And, you know, the whistle, they could see the catcher catcher's fingers, and they would whistle. Some whistle for a fastball, a certain whistle for a curveball. So, and these old timers were the ones who really tried to do all this old stuff, because they used to do it back in their, back in the 30s and 40s. But if you could cheat in any way, some of the guys would, and that was just part of the game, I guess.
Your book is full of extraordinary stories, including stories about meeting presidents and being on the Ed Sullivan Show and all kinds of things that never in your wildest dreams could you imagine happening to little old Ransom Jackson.
I'm Little Rock.
I think one of the really best stories you tell in the whole book in that regard is when you talk about meeting one of the true legends of the 20th century, Red Grange.
Yeah.
Explain to our listeners how this happened.
Well, I was at the ballpark in Chicago, and after the game, a guy comes up with another guy and says, I'd like you to meet Red Grange. And I said, good gosh. And he says, he's very interested in you because you... Yeah.
Explain to our listeners how this happened.
Well, I was at the ballpark in Chicago, and after the game, a guy comes up with another guy and says, I'd like you to meet Red Grange. And I said, good gosh. And he says, he's very interested in you because you played football for 3 years. And so I met him, and he was talking. He said, would you like to come down to my apartment? And I said, in a flash. And so we went down there, and so I spent a couple of hours down there talking to him. And we just talked about old-time football and, things that are different from that day to the previous days. And I walked out of there, and I thought for the rest of my life, I've spent 2 hours with Red Grange.
Hmm.
And so there, a lot of people haven't. So there.
Amazing. You also have a great, great chapter in which you talk about the way in which you have sometimes been mistaken for other famous Jacksons, like Randy Jackson, a judge for American Idol, and sometimes mistaken for other contemporary.
I'm not mistaken personally. These are fan mails.
Right, exactly.
I don't look a thing like these guys.
And even got one you said that was addressed to Shoeless Joe Jackson, who played back in the teens. And I like the way you open this chapter where you talk about how these fan letters have changed. The way they open has changed over the years. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Well, I don't know what you're talking about. It used to be, used to watch you, and you were one of my favorite players. Then letters come later. My dad told me how great you are, and then they start coming. My grandfather told me how great you were. Are you talking about that?
Yes. I
The fans got older and older.
Of course. I want to finish out with a poignant moment where you talk about your dad. And, of course, your dad was very, very important to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a really special moment in the book is when you actually talk about a moment in the 1950s. By this point, you're in the major leagues, and things have gone a little sour for your father's laundry business.
Mm-hmm.
And you ended up writing your dad a check. Can you tell our listeners about that moment in your life?
I worked down there in the off season for a couple of years. I didn't get paid or anything, but I'd be out there slopping sheets and driving this and that. We had about 30 people, and we had bought this for an investment, Dad and I, and it just didn't work out. So they had to declare bankruptcy, and they told me that that I owed to the fabulous IRS $6,000, and my World Series check was $6,000. What a coincidence. So I took my World Series check and paid off to the IRS and went on about my way.
That points out something that is kind of an interesting reality that's hard for us to imagine now. You say in the off season, we were regular guys. We're usually in the phone book. And and in the off season, you would work in the family's laundry business or sell life insurance. I mean, you were ordinary guys, and I'm sure that's part of what is still sort of astonishing as you look back at that era of your life.
Well, you know, to me, people are people. You know, of course, I've bumped into and been around and met